Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today I'll be talking to David Ostrowski about his new book, Roberto Alomar, The Complicated Life and Legacy of a Baseball Hall of Famer. David is a sports writer for the Atlanta Jewish Times. His last book was 1993, a signature season in football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Paul, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Sure. So as I told you before we came on the air, I love the book and excited to talk about it. You start off the book with really the controversial moment of certainly at least his playing career, the controversial moment of his career with the incident with John Hirschbeck. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and why you decide to start the book with that controversial moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that happened, let's see, almost 28 years ago now, and it's still the singular event from his Hall of Fame career that people most identify Roberto Alomar with, and probably will be for the remainder of his life. It's unbelievable how an event that has, in which the two main characters, obviously Alomar and Hirschbeck, not only made up, but have become good friends through the years, still dominates people's perception of this, you know, ball player. So I think it really had to be the moment that introduced Roberto Alomar to readers, just because, again, he's so identified by this one event. And I think what really gets lost in it is, even at the time, what wasn't so terrible was the act of spitting itself, but what happened afterwards, where he, you know, brought up this umpire's son who had just passed away, 8 years old, horrible tragedy. And that really escalated the conflict. But I also think what gets lost in it too is the fact that there was something that was said that did provoke him to spit. And I just think it's interesting that a lot of times people like to forget, you know, there's two sides to every story. And even in the immediate aftermath of the fight, that really wasn't discussed at all, you know, what provoked him.
And what was it exactly that provoked him? Do we know?
And, you know, allegedly a derogatory homosexual remark.
Yeah. So, it's evident in reading your book that in order to understand Robbie Alomar, we have to kind of understand where he came from, you know, both his family and in Puerto Rico. What is the history of the Alomar family and its relationship to baseball?
Yeah, I mean, his father was Sandy Sr., came up with the Braves. At the time, I guess they were the Milwaukee Braves in 1965. And he, you know, was a utility guy, but he made one All-Star game. And he was just a very respected ball player. His brothers played in the minors, Sandy Sr.'s did. And then Robbie and Sandy kind of followed him in the family business. You know, Sandy was a catcher, Robbie was a second baseman. So, I mean, other than the Clemente, or Robbie Clemente, the Alomar family was just, you know, royalty for baseball on that island. And up until the incident with Hirschbeck, Robbie had just a sparkling reputation in the game. And he just, you know, winning back-to-back World Series and 92-93 for Toronto, obviously, you know, just a defensive wizard. Yeah, he had a run-in with an umpire here and there, and maybe things kind of didn't end well in Toronto. But for the most part, I mean, this guy just had a great reputation that coincided with his family's.
And it was interesting to read about, you know, the differences between Robbie and Sandy Jr.,
yep.
You know, personality in general,
yep.
And the relationship to baseball, frankly, yep. You know, as kids coming up. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, from what I understood, and this was, to be very honest with you, this part of the book kind of just came from secondary sources, different articles and other materials I read, but Sandy was just not as enthralled with the sport that to the level that Robbie was. I mean, Robbie just, you know, tagged along with his father for every, you know, winter league game at night in the Puerto Rican Winter League, and, you know, wanted to stay at the play forever, where Sandy had other interests, whether it was, you know, Taekwondo or, you know, planes. And Robbie's really singular interest was baseball. And I think to a large extent, even though Sandy was older, Robbie was the reason that Sandy stuck with baseball, ultimately, you know, got drafted into the Padres organization and became a big league catcher and a real good one, a 6-time All-Star. So, yeah.
And, you know, as you mentioned, Robbie just from such a young age seemed to be on that trajectory to pro ball. He seemed to, one, he was obsessed with the game. And, you know, as you recounted, just had the natural ability that people saw from a young age how talented he was.
Yeah, I mean, when he was like 6 years old, I mentioned this anecdote in the book. There was a scout, I think, for the St. Louis Cardinals who saw him, you know, flip a ball around with his brother or one of the other kids whose dad was playing, and was like, you know, can I sign him now? I mean, it was not that dissimilar from, like, you know, Bobby Orr from Boston, who, when he was an adolescent, was playing and dominating against kids several years older than him, teenagers. You know, Robbie, even when he was like a early teen, when he was 13, was taking infield with his dad's friends in this Puerto Rican Winter League, and he fit it, you know. So it was strikingly obvious to everyone that he had off the charts talent, and I think that certainly manifested itself years later in the big leagues, at least for the first, you know, half of his career.
Right. And then, of course, he started playing pro ball at a very young age in the minor leagues. I believe he was 17 when he joined the Padres,
right,
organization.
Yep.
How was that transition for him to pro ball?
I mean, I think it was hard for a number of reasons. As you point out, he was exceptionally young. He was 17. That was summer of 85. He was playing in single A for Charleston Rainbows. His dad was on the coaching staff. So on the field, I think it went fine. I mean, he hit a shade under 300 his first year and then really progressed from that point on. But I think for the language, there was still a language barrier. I think being so young, he couldn't go out and drink with the guys. You know, I think he was kind of, you know, aloof in a sense, understandably so. And then I think, as I kind of detail in the book, but maybe don't want to give it away too much, he had a couple of run-ins with some teammates, which, again, I think is only to be expected just because there was, you know, a 6-7 year gap from him and some of these guys who had been playing in the States professionally for a while now.
Right. Yeah, there's some great anecdotes in the book about, you know, the minor league years and what that was like for him. And some of the people he crossed paths with, I think at the single A level, he was teammates with Carlos Baerga for a short time. And it just it's crazy to think two incredible talents, you know, were teammates like that at, you know, both second basemen as well, of course. So at age 20, he's called up to the big leagues.
Yep.
Again, remarkable how young he was. And he had an impressive rookie year. You know, it was clear. Obviously, he was a defensive standout. I mean, that was evident very early. Do you think the Padres, did they view him as like, well, this guy could be the best second baseman in baseball? This guy is a potential, you know, future Hall of Famer. Were they that enamored with him?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, I kind of go into the book, which is not unique to Robbie. They manipulated his call up, his contract. In a sense, you know, they didn't want him to come up right away in the 88 season because they wanted to delay his eligibility for arbitration, not to get into all the, you know, technical, you know, mechanics of it, but they were happy to wait. You know, they knew he was going to eventually make the big coin, and they, you know, they basically, he should have been up there probably in 87, if not earlier, if not, you know, at least the beginning of 88. But I think there were other guys ahead of him. You know, Randy Reddy was a veteran that they were kind of hoping to play more. Gary Templeton. So I don't think they necessarily, Joey Cora, you know, he wasn't like, oh, you know, he was necessarily the, you know, star middle infielder of the future. And then obviously a couple of years later, they trade him along with Joe Carter, the Toronto Blue Jays, for Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez. So I don't think it was necessarily like this. Well, they knew he was obviously a lot of potential. I don't think they first saw a 12-time All-Star and future Hall of Famer necessarily.
Right. Yeah. You know, we talked about a little about his struggles when he first joined the minor leagues. What was he like in the locker room and as a teammate, you know, as a young major leaguer?
I mean, from the guys I spoke with and from the articles I read, he certainly didn't cause any trouble, but, you know, he was quiet, really kept to himself. When he joined the Padres in 88, his father was the third base coach, and for a little bit, Sandy was on the team before he got, Sandy Jr. was on the team before he got traded. He was quiet. He kept to himself. I mean, he didn't really, you know, he was a good teammate. There were issues on that team with Jack Clark in his final year and Tom Gwynn, and a couple other guys, but, you know, he didn't get in anyone's way at all.
And, you know, you mentioned the trade to Toronto, which was a huge deal at the time, and it wasn't, not because of Robbie, you know, it was really more the two sluggers, Carter, McGriff, and of course, I mean, Tony Fernandez had a wonderful career, particularly as a defensive shortstop. What was the reaction to that trade? I guess around the league, I mean, how was that trade perceived?
I mean, I don't think anyone thought, like you said, you know, Robbie Alomar was the, very few people, I should say, thought he was the focal point of the trade. I think people didn't understand why would the Blue Jays get rid of Fred McGriff, who at that point was an all-star slugger. As you mentioned, Fernandez was a really good shortstop. But I think really McGriff, like, why would you trade, you know, him? He was a little younger than Joe Carter at the time, I believe. So it just didn't make much sense. And, you know, the Blue Jays had gotten really close a couple times in the late 80s. They just, you know, a lot of people, especially in Toronto, were not very happy with that trade for sure.
Yeah, I'm guessing they came around pretty quickly within a couple of years and a couple of championships.
Yeah, I mean, his first year in Toronto was 91, and they were pretty good. I mean, they made it to the ALCS, and then obviously in 92 and 93, they won back-to-back World Series. And 92 may have been Robbie's best all-around year. I think he made like five errors or something, you know, while hitting well over 300. And I mean, it's insane just, you know, what he did. Well, never an MVP, but he was always kind of in the discussion. And just to give you, you know, one little anecdote, you know, I understand the strikeout in the way, but in 94, 95 combined, I think he had like eight errors. And then the next year in the All-Star game in 96 in Philadelphia, he's batting third for the American League. And it's his first year in Baltimore. So it just kind of gives you a sense of what kind of five-tool star this guy was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for those that were too young to see him, what was it that made him so special? Was it that he could do everything?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're talking about a guy who, lifetime 300 hitter, literally, that was his lifetime batting average. He had well over 2,700 hits, so he wasn't too far from 3,000. He snuck in 210 home runs, great bunter. But that's not even the best part of his game. That was really his just, you know, defensive prowess. He was a 10-time Gold Glove winner. He maybe didn't have the greatest arm in the world, but he made plays and got the balls that no other second baseman on the planet could make at that time anyway. You know, he was fast. He stole bases. He was a smart ball player. He was clutch. You know, in the 92 ALCS, he had his career-defining moment, at least offensively, with the home run against Eckersley. You know, he had a very, very good postseason. He was the ALCS MVP in 92. You know, just overall, there weren't many guys who could impact the game in that many ways that Alomar could.
Yeah, and, you know, as someone who I'm a Yankee fan, grew up a Yankee fan, and so he played, you know, in the much of the prime of his career for two rivals of the Yankees, the Blue Jays and the Orioles.
Right.
But I couldn't help but love watching him play, and I think the defining thing for me was how smooth he was.
Yeah. It looked so easy. Yeah.
He looked so easy, particularly in the field. I mean, just his glove work and the way he moved. the way he moved in the field and on the base pass as well. He didn't look like he was running that hard, but you knew he was running fast. And he just, even at the plate, he had a pretty swing. If he laid out a bunt, he just had a great feel with the bat. Everything just looked so easy and so smooth.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a perfect way to describe him. You know, and a couple of guys even told me, like, yeah, he put his work in, he ran, he lifted, whatever. But it's like, it's almost, he didn't even have to do that and would have been a really, really good player, you know? Like, it just came so easy to him. And, I mean, there's very few guys I can think of. Ken Griffey Jr. comes to mind as another one who, you know, just made it look so easy, you know? And mechanics were just so perfect. But this guy was just, he was oozing with natural talent. And, you know, I always hate to play this, but I will. You know, his career really wrapped up basically when he was like 33, you know, after he left Cleveland and got traded to the Mets. And had he strung together at that point, you know, four, five, six more great years, I think you're talking about one of the greatest players ever. But his career did really hit a downfall, you know, starting in his like age 33 season, his first year in the Mets. And it spiraled pretty quickly at that point, you know, to the point that 2 years later, he basically had no choice but to retire at, you know, the fairly young age of 37, you know, where some guys are still playing well past that, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, one guy that came to mind to me was another middle infielder, not to bring it back to the Yankees, but Derek Jeter.
Yeah.
I think, obviously, Robbie was a superior defensive player.
Yeah.
But offensively, they were, you know, numbers-wise, were somewhat similar. Yeah. But Derek kept it going until he was like 39, 40, and, you know, was, I think, fifth or sixth all time in hits. And he, you know, whereas Robbie dropped off in the early mid 30s, Jeter kept going and you know, accumulated. He kept accumulating the stats and the runs and the all that. But
you're absolutely right. When, I mean, Robbie was 34, so his first full season in Queens in the Mets. He hit like 266, I want to say, that year. Basically had no power, maybe hit like 10 or so home runs. I don't know. And he wasn't he was a decent defensive player, but no longer great, but he wasn't compiling stats at that point. And to the point that he was basically a platoon player his last year or two. And again, I would like to just reemphasize, you know, a fairly young age, 35, you know, where had he, again, been able to play at an all-star level for 5 or 6 years, I think he's in the conversation with a Jeter or even like a Ripken. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And what's interesting to me is, I seem to have recalled it this way, but your book confirmed it to me. It seemed like he just kind of dropped off a cliff, you know, I mean, and his last, I don't want to quote the statistics exactly, but his last year at Cleveland, I think he hit 330 something and had still had some pop. And then, you know, it seemed to be at the peak of his powers. And then within a year, it looked like he was done. Was there a mental aspect to that? I mean, how did he drop off? I know you probably there's no clear answer to that, but why do you think he dropped off so precipitously like that?
No, it's a great question. I think the actual number was like 336 in 2001 he hit, you know, and pretty sure knocking over 100 runs and was, you know, playing in an all-star in Safeco in Seattle. His final all-star game. And then the next year, the Mets, he's at best a mediocre player. I don't know. I mean, I think Shea's obviously or was a much harder place to hit, you know, than maybe some parts. He was getting used to the National League. He was in the city, you know, for his entire career outside of San Diego. He played in the American League. But that's still not a reason. You know, I don't know. It's kind of a mystery. Who knows what else is going on in his life. He just split up with Mary Pierce. He was engaged to her, the tennis star, right that winter in 2001. But, you know, I don't know. He was getting older. Sure, some people, it doesn't really matter. Some, you know, it does. But yeah, he just really dropped off a cliff. There's no other way to describe it. To the point the Mets traded him the following year to the White Sox and got hardly anything in return for him.
Yeah. And of course, you mentioned, he won those two championships in Toronto. And I think those teams are a little forgotten. I mean, talking about like a murderer's row. I mean, that lineup was just fantastic. How important was he to those teams?
I mean, it was a great lineup, as you pointed out. So in both years they had, you know, Devon White, Alomar, John Olerud, Joe Carter, and in 92 they had Dave Winfield. He left and they replaced him with Paul Molitor. Then year after that, the pitching was decent, but it was really the hitting. I mean, he was the crux of those lineups both years. You know, he was either batting second or third. He had great seasons both years. As I mentioned earlier, 92, just the only handful of errors and the sparkling offensive numbers. There were a few guys who impacted the game as much as he did, if any. And also, I think at that pivotal moment I kind of go into in 92 with the ALCS game four against Oakland, it looks like they're going to lose and cough up this series lead. And he hits this, you know, pivotal home run against Eckersley, who was the league MVP that year. And it really kind of saved their season in many ways. So I don't think anyone's more responsible than Robbie. And the unfortunate thing was when they did have their reunion in 92, 30-year reunion of the championship team, this was so in 2022, so a couple summers ago, you know, he wasn't invited back. He's no longer associated with the Blue Jays or Major League Baseball.
Right. We'll get into that. But he left, of course, in 95. Why did he, I guess after the 95 season, why didn't he leave Toronto at that time at the height of his career?
That's a great question. He was living at the Sky Dome too. Right. You know, so he had it kind of neat. I mean, he was entering free agency. The Orioles were willing to pay more. The Orioles really had a huge shopping spree that winter going into the 96 season, where they got a bunch of free agents, including Robbie. You know, they really shelved out a lot of big dough for him. And I think even though he really liked Cito Gaston, I think the team was really kind of clearly shedding payroll. They had just traded David Cone at the trade deadline in 95. And they did not have a good year in 95, if I recall. And the same thing in 94. They really had a big fall off from the 93 World Series team. And, you know, it was kind of getting to be an older team. And I don't think he really thought he had any future there. And then, again, just free agency. I mean, this was the time, you got to remember, where guys were starting to make really big money. Not that he wasn't making good money in Toronto, but, you know, he had a chance to the open market to make as much as he was worth and cashed in on that opportunity.
And then, of course, during his first season in Baltimore, it was the infamous Hirschbeck incident. How is he? You know, you talk in the book about how he was, you know, kind of viewed and treated by the media and the fans, and I'll let people read about that. How is he viewed by people in the game? You know, teammates, opponents, managers.
Well, I mean, the umpires threatened to strike out of the playoffs. If Al Mark played, they said they would sit. And obviously that didn't happen because there was a 96 playoffs, which you might remember as one of the Yankees, you know, came glory. But, you know, I think in the Orioles clubhouse, guys stood behind him. I think, you know, the Orioles fans, guys stood behind him. It was pretty ruthless for other fan bases around the country, certainly in New York and the ALCS, yes, and they played Baltimore, and even in Cleveland, the ALDS. It was interesting. Like a 1 year time story, I was reading Mariano Duncan, who's also a Latino ball player for the Phillies at the time, I'm pretty sure. And he called him out. Maybe it was, he was the Yankees. He was playing for the Yankees then, right? He was on the Phillies a couple years earlier. You know, I think at that point also, the fact that Ripken, this was his chance to win his first World Series since 83, he had been back in the playoffs in 13 years, that was slowly becoming the dominant story. Line, I guess, as well as the Jeffrey Meyer incident where he, you know, robbed the home run, helped Derek Jeter get home. So I think those somewhat took over the spotlight from this incident.
And he had a couple of more, you know, very good seasons in Baltimore after that, and then ended up heading to Cleveland to play for another very talented team in Cleveland, and kind of the big thing I remember, and you talk about in the book, is his double play partner Omar Vizquel. And have you ever seen a better double play combo than Robbie Alomar and Omar Vizquel?
I mean, I can't recall one. You know, I know Whitaker and Schrammel were pretty good. Off the top of my head, I can. I went through some different YouTube clips as I was doing this, and I don't know. You know, it's hard because, you know, if you go back in time, I'm sure there were some great ones. But no, I think for 3 years, this was pretty damn impressive. They were like acrobats in the diamond. And every pitcher spoke to you. You're absolutely great about the writers, you know, seeing the play. And it's rare to have people want to pay for a ticket to see defense. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Pedro Martinez pitching, sure, Ken Griffey Jr., Mike Trout, you know, Albert Pujols, fine. But, you know, see defense, that's literally why a lot of people went to see those games.
Yeah, you're right. That's a great point. It's crazy. Because Vizquel had that, again, the same word comes to mind, smooth.
Yeah.
Vizquel was smooth, yeah. The way Alomar was smooth. And yeah. So together, it was magical. You know, we talked a little bit about his transition from Cleveland to New York. And, man, I lived in New York at that time. And I as I said, I was a Yankee fan. The Mets fans were, I think to this day, we still hate Robbie Alomar because of, you know, just he.
Yeah.
Anytime, you know, a guy falls that short of expectations for whatever reason,
sure.
The fan base doesn't react well. But, you know, it's interesting because Robbie was a guy who, from an early age, obviously, as you said, loved the game, followed his dad to the ballpark and wanted to be around the game. Heck, he lived it. He lived at the Sky Dome, right? He lived right. at the stadium.
Right.
But there were times in his career, and certainly, you know, it came up with the Mets, where guys questioned his effort and how much he really wanted to be there. And I don't know, how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm from Boston, and, you know, one thing that kind of kept thinking about was, like, Manny Ramirez at the end. It was really bad here. He was not hustling down the line. He was olaying plays in the outfield, take the random day off for no explicable reason. It was bad in Queens for him in 02 and 03. And this is just judging by what many different writers commented, you know, in different accounts. And there's really no excuse. He wasn't injured, you know, as far as I could tell. I mean, you look at the game logs and he played the vast majority of games. I mean, the team's culture, it seemed like it was pretty toxic. There were some guys who just, you know, named names because there's quite a few. But it was not a good, you know, culture. Bobby Valentine left after the 02 season. You know, they had a lot of contracts of high-priced veterans who were kind of the back nine. Jeremy Burnett, Mo Vaughn come to mind. Yeah, I mean, it was just, again, a guy who kind of just went through the motions for 1.5 years.
Yeah. And you retired in 2004, and as you said, he was 35 or 36, wasn't that old for a player of his caliber.
Nope.
What is his legacy? Forget all the controversy, forget Hirschbeck, but what is his legacy as a player?
So, I'm very honest. He's not the most, you know, popular player who are, you know, in baseball, of all the Hall of Famers, you know. He would have been a first ballot Hall of Famer hands down had it not been for the Hirschbeck incident. He's got one of the most impressive resumes of all time, but, you know, he's not remembered fondly. Just, and I can say that, you know, a fair amount of certainty only because of all the social media, you know, chatter that I've seen since having this book published. I think if you live in Toronto, you've got a pretty good, you know, memory of him. And if you're a diehard Blue Jays fan, absolutely, you know, you can remember. But I think for a lot of people, he just, you know, never did like the endorsements or have the great publicity that you mentioned Jeter, you know, or Ripken or Frank Thomas or, you know, Griffey. So I think in that sense, he's underappreciated. But I do think there's quite a few fans who will never forgive him for the Hirschbeck incident. And then on top of that, the fact that he has been, you know, banned from baseball permanently.
Yeah, and then I want to get into that a little bit. I mean, he, you know, has had a number of, I guess you say, controversial incidents, you know, after his career, sexual assault accusations, yeah. I mean, some really ugly stuff where he, yeah. you know, accused of passing on AIDS to people
yeah.
with knowledge. I mean, first of all, to your knowledge, does Roberto Alomar have AIDS or HIV?
So I was talking about this with someone the other night. So no, I don't think so, because now those women who accused him of that ever tested positive, he initially denied it. So I do have to take his word for that. He's a very private person, and while he never really went into too much details, from his attorneys and even him personally in 2009, he denied it. So I'm just going to go on that and the fact that not one of those women ever tested positive. So I'm inclined to say no.
You know, for you as a writer, you've covered this guy's whole life, you know, got to know a great deal about him, and he was a spectacular player. What is it like to have to, cover, you know, the dark stuff, the sexual assault, the AIDS allegations, there were a number of, you know, sexual assault related allegations. Yeah. What was it like for you to cover that, and how do you go about weaving that into his story?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, as many of your listeners probably know, 3 years ago, you know, MLB banned him from baseball indefinitely because there was allegations from the 2014 incident, totally irrespective of the other allegations you mentioned regarding HIV in 2009. That forced Commissioner Rob Manfred, as well as the Blue Jays, to wash their hands clean. And he's still in the Hall of Fame because in 2011, he was inducted. He was in good standing. Yeah, I mean, it was hard in the sense of, like, okay, I knew when I started to write this was not a Jim Tomei or an Abier Martinez, someone who had just, like, this immaculate reputation. So I kind of knew what I was getting into. But it was disappointing to see because he had done a lot of really good things in retirement, whether it was Hurricane Maria relief efforts or befriending the Hirschbecks, which is probably my favorite part of his story. He did a lot for special needs kids in Toronto, for children, you know, cancer patients. But then there's this alleged dark side of him. So it was very hard. And I'll just say it was really good. I did almost every single interview before these 21 allegations came out.
Mm.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
The interesting thing is not one person I interviewed contacted me afterwards to say, oh, I don't want to be included in this book, you know. But it was still really good that I got all these interviews done. That would have been the hardest thing, for sure. I don't even think there would have been a book, you know, had this been, like, right when I was a year earlier when I started it.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. And, you know, we talked earlier in the conversation about his family's reputation in Puerto Rico especially, and I know baseball craze island that is. After all the controversy and all that, what is Robbie's reputation in the island at this point?
Yeah, it's a good question. That's one area where I don't think it's too tarnished. I do think he still has a pretty good reputation. He does a lot with youth leagues, you know, with amateur baseball there. He owns a team in one of the winter leagues. He's there a lot, engaging in the community. So I think that's where his reputation is still pretty good. And his brother, Sandy, is still coaching. He's been first base coach for a long time for the Cleveland Guardians. And I think in that respect, you know, the Alomar family has still got a pretty good foothold in Major League Baseball. But I do think in Puerto Rico, he's still more or less beloved.
And of course,
and I think it's Toronto too. I think for the most part, it's Toronto also.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, why do you think he wasn't in more commercials? I mean, he was, in addition to being an extraordinary player, he's a good looking guy.
Yep.
You know, was it just personality based?
Prior to
Hirschbeck.
Yeah. No, I don't know. You know, he was quiet, very, very quiet, really kept to himself. Didn't seek out the spotlight by any means. Maybe playing in Toronto, you know, obviously it's north of the border, so it's perhaps a different dynamic. Toronto's a hockey city, right? You know, had he been in New York playing for the Mets or Yankees in his glory days, I think it'd be a different story, you know? I mean, you could kind of say the same thing for someone like a Paul Molitor, for example, who played most of his career in Milwaukee, but, you know, sorry, put up much better numbers than, you know, a guy like Derek Jeter, you know, if you don't mind me saying so, and you're just, and, you know, probably would have been able to get similar exposure to a Jeter or A-Rod, you know, had he played in a bigger market. So, I don't know. I think, you know, the fact that he was quiet at that time, his English was still a work in progress, I think, and the fact that he, again, didn't play in a major American city, were not in his favor.
Yeah, I'm glad you were up as English, because that's kind of a theme in the book, and, you know, I think it's important to point out that he pushed for Spanish speaking people in the locker room in the organization.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long ago, but I don't know the statistics to back this up, but I don't think the game was quite as Hispanic as it is.
No, not at all. That's a great point. Yeah, not at all. When he was in the early 90s, no way.
Yeah, and it was more, I'm trying to think of like an Hispanic player, maybe Poppy, who really broke through. Because at that time, we're like during
Sammy Sosa, maybe?
Yeah, but Sammy's a good one. But during Robbie's prime, like, can you think of a Hispanic player who did have a lot of endorsements in this country?
No.
Until Sammy, probably.
Yeah, because I think Sosa, right, when he was the whole Chasing McGuire
era. Yeah, Sammy, and then, like, Pedro and Poppy and guys like that. But at that time, it wasn't. Yeah.
I mean, like, for another one that comes to mind, I guess it's kind of similar to Robbie, would be Vlade Guerrero, who.
Yeah,
given to the season of like 97, 98, and great, great, great players in the Hall of Fame, and never really saw him, get the love and never any controversy surrounding him at all. But no, McGuire, Griffey, Bonds, Frank Thomas, Eckersley, they got a lot more love, obviously Jeter, deservedly so.
And I think some of it is, you talk in the book, chicks dig the long ball. I mean, Robbie,
he was not a home power hitter. Nope.
Yeah.
Right.
But he kind of was a little bit, right? Because that's the thing too, is, people, we forget so easily back. That was a time when you still had guys, middle infielders who were hitting 1 and 2 home runs a year.
Right.
Right. That was still, so for a guy to be, for a middle infielder to be able to hit 20 home runs was a big deal.
It was. I mean, Ripken was the first, really, at the vanguard of that, when he hit 20, 25 home runs, and was like, oh, my God, this middle infielder is hitting, has some pop. It was a big deal. I mean, the numbers, the power numbers are very similar to Jeter's, right, where there were some years where Robbie would hit 20, 25 home runs, 18 home runs, a threat in other years, where obviously it wasn't that. But, again, I think that kind of just speaks to his ability to really, a factor in all different parts of the game that very few players of his generation could say.
Right. Yeah. Do you have any idea what Robbie's doing now that he's banned from baseball, which was in his blood? What is he up to now?
So he's living in Toronto. He remarried a woman named Kim Perks in 2012. He's got a daughter with her. He does go back to Puerto Rico, as I mentioned. He's has this franchise, RA12, it's called, that plays in Puerto Rican Winter League, where he gets a lot of young kids to come and play for them. He does clinics. And I noticed also just recently, maybe a couple months ago, he started to do a few autograph signings. He did one in Westchester, New York. He's doing one in the Baltimore area in a couple weeks. So he's getting out a little bit, but, he doesn't MLB events, very much at all. He's never at Hall of Fame induction weekend. So things changed drastically as of 3 years ago.
Yeah. Well, once again, I want to say the name of David's book is Roberto Alomar, The Complicated Life and Legacy of a Baseball Hall of Famer. I really enjoyed it. I think all my listeners will as well. I think, we talked about the controversies and how, that kind of change may have changed the kind of book it was to some extent. But to me, the controversies are a lot of what make it a great book, right? If you take a figure who's just a glowing reputation and doesn't have any dark spots, it's not as interesting. And so the controversy is, it's a shame in a way that, that they seem to have overshadowed, what was just a brilliant career. Where would you rank Robbie? And, is he a top 5 second baseman all time?
I think so. It's tricky because, you're talking about guys like Roger Saulsby and Eddie Collins who played eons ago. It's a different era, and even Joe Morgan. But in my book, he is. You look at the whole overall package. And the one in modern day who I kind of draw a parallel to is in Houston, Jose Altuve. Coincidentally, also has his own scandal, although not nearly, the cheating. Not to this level. And will likely be a first Hall of Famer as well. But it's similar, you know, the numbers. Altuve's won an MVP. Robbie never won an MVP. Altuve's won a batting title, something Robbie never did. But Altuve also doesn't have all the gold gloves that Robbie had. Yeah. I think that's a comparison you could make.
Yeah. I think that's fair. Yeah, again, I think, you know, it's a good title for the book. I mean, the operative word is complicated, right? It's a complicated life and legacy. Even the Hirschbeck incident is a wonderful story in itself, how he and Hirschbeck end up becoming friends, and he supports Hirschbeck's organization and all that. And so there's a lot of good stuff in this book. Go check it out. David, thank you so much for coming on to talk about it. I really enjoyed
it. My pleasure, Paul. Same here. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you, sir.